Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open with some top stories on important issues impacting the future of East County. Santee's City Council voted to approve Vanita Ranch, a massive and controversial housing development that's been in the works for 20 years. Opponents criticized some council members as biased for taking developer contributions. Now, an environmental group says it will circulate a petition seeking to overturn the decision. Parkway Plaza, East County's largest regional shopping mall, has been sold and the new developer wants to convert the property to housing and offices, but it may face opposition from the City Council, and we'll have details. County supervisors voted to withdraw a grant application to convert a motel in La Mesa to housing for the homeless, after revelations of backroom dealing between the developer and a council member who kept his colleagues and the public in the dark until after the application was submitted. Our newsmaker interview today is with Mark Papenfuss, and he's a candidate running for the La Mesa City Council. On the second half of our show, we'll have some national news stories from Public News Service, including President Trump's statement suggesting he may not accept an election loss and wants to get rid of ballots and let the Supreme Court decide the outcome. We'll also have stories on a new COVID-19 vaccine trial and on smoke pollution from western wildfires. We do have some good news on San Diego staying in the red tier for COVID-19 and avoiding new business closures for now. Nobody signed up to run for a seat on San Miguel Fire District's board, so if you live in the La Presa or Spring Valley area, you can apply to be appointed to fill the vacant seat on Green Scene. Hear about some green waste recycling events coming up in Potrero and Jacumba Hot Springs. Plus, learn about efforts to get monarch butterflies declared endangered after a 99% drop in their population. We also have information on voter registration, and finally, we'll replay one of our perennial favorites, Master Gardener Connie Beck, with advice on fall tree plantings. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
For East County Magazine, I'm John Sepulvedo. By a 4-1 majority, the Santee City Council approved the controversial Vanita Ranch development that will add nearly 3,000 homes and about 8,000 residents to a city that has been fighting over the project for most of its 40-year history. The vote came shortly after midnight, September 24th, following a mind-numbing six-hour session that was broadcast online, with each of the five elected officials casting their votes from their homes due to the continued COVID-19 pandemic. According to the city, 312 viewers watched the marathon session, the longest in Santee history. Councilman Stephen Houlihan cast the sole no vote. In a single vote covering eight separate legal actions, the council provided all the necessary approvals the developer HomeFed Corp has been seeking since 2017, when the San Marcos-based company submitted its plan for some 2,400 acres of rolling hills in the city's northeast quadrant. Councilman Ron Hall said giving approval for the project was preferable to denying it because HomeFed could then return with a plan for potentially more than 4,000 units, yet without any benefits to the city. I'm kind of in a catch-22 on this, Hall said. Do I really want to turn this down and lose everything we have? Or do I want to take it reluctantly and at least get something out of it? And we are getting something out of it. Among the biggest somethings Hall referred to was HomeFed's promise to fund improvements to State Route 52 to relieve traffic congestion and have those fixes done before any new homeowners move in. Other perks the city stood to lose if it rejected the plan was a new fire station at the site, a new school, accessible open space with new parks and trails that made up about two-thirds of the land, a working farm and vineyard, a solar energy plant, and a varied stock of move-up housing. On a net revenue basis, Santee would gain an estimated $1.4 million annually from taxes after the city pays for the expenses associated with the project, according to the developer's presentation. Because the development already has the legal right to build 1,380 units, Hall said, HomeFed could legally build those units and then add on another 2,760 units because of a state law that allows for two granny flats per parcel of land. That would bring the total number of units to 4,140 in Santee. Councilmember Rob McNellis, who made the motion to approve this project, asserted the Finita Ranch specific plan requires that the developer completes all the infrastructure improvements, including all of the Highway 52 fixes, before the city issues occupancy permits on those first houses. If they can't get that done, they'll never be able to sell one home in development, he said. That was an interesting turn for McNellis, who once told East County Magazine he wanted to put the issue before voters and would defer to their judgment on this controversial project.
That I am absolutely in support of the citizens of Santee having their own vote on this. Take it out of the hands of the Santee City Council. Let's get the citizens to vote on it. I have no problems with that.
Santee Councilwoman Laura Cavall issued a similar statement in this 2018 exchange with East County Magazine.
I want the voters to have a voice on Finita Ranch, and I don't know if you know this, but the district race for District 3 is only a two-year term, and the voters will be voting on projects like Finita Ranch, but I think that's the big hot button. That's the one that seems to...
So you think that the council shouldn't try to push it through and approve it?
Oh, no. They let the voters decide in 2020, for sure.
Yet neither McNellis nor Cavall responded to charges of broken promises to put Finita Ranch to a public vote. Had they voted to give residents a say, that could have scuttled the project, but probably only temporarily due to the previous property rights. A slim majority, or 25 of the 49 speakers weighing in at the public hearing portion of the meeting, urged the council to vote against Finita Ranch. Most argued that building housing in an area prone to wildfires will endanger lives, as well as eliminate the natural habitat of dozens of plants and animals, including several endangered species. Some speakers questioned the ethics of those four council members who accepted political contributions from the developer or other real estate interests that are tied to this project, saying those donations tainted their objectivity. This reeks of a backroom deal that everyone is on except the citizens of Santee, said Gloria Garrick. Steve Houlihan, who was elected in 2016 on a slow growth platform and doesn't accept any money from developers, said while accepting campaign contributions from entities with projects coming from council approval may be legal, the optics of the process is horrible. Quote, it almost reeks of suppression that we're trying to get this through before November 3rd, said Houlihan, about the timing of the project's vote that prevents residents from weighing in on Finita Ranch. Santee's ballot includes a general plan initiative called Measure N, which would require any proposed development that doesn't conform to the current plan to go to a vote. Finita Ranch would have triggered a vote because of its much higher density than allowed in an earlier version. Both Santee Mayor John Minto and Councilwoman Cavall wanted to make sure that HomeFed's recent change to exclude an extension of Magnolia Avenue from the project would not threaten residents in the event of a wildfire evacuation. Fire Chief John Garlow and consultant Mike Huff assured council members that the change wouldn't impact evacuation times and that technology improvements have made evacuations far safer than in the past. HomeFed decided to exclude building the extension to the project last month, saying it wanted to use the $5 million budgeted for the road extension for improvements to Highway 52 because most residents said traffic congestion was their main concern about the new housing. The developer also said that by removing the extension from this project, it would allow McNellis, who owns property near Magnolia Avenue, to vote on the project and eliminate a possible conflict of interest, causing his recusal. Houlihan and other speakers said the change should have required the city to revise its environmental impact report and conduct another public comment period so all parties could weigh in on the changes. That would have certainly caused the project to be delayed until after the election. If Measure N passes, then Finita Ranch would have required a public vote for approval. Houlihan made a motion to delay the vote until after the elections, but it died when no one seconded that motion on the Santee City Council. For East County Magazine, I'm John Sepulveda.
This is Miriam Raftery with a late-breaking update on the Finita Ranch story. Shortly after that council vote, Van Collinsworth, head of Preserve Wild Santee, issued this statement: Preserve Wild Santee intends to challenge the council action and give the people of Santee the opportunity to decide their own destiny. Campaign contributions document the council is biased toward the developer that helped elect them, he said. Collinsworth says the public has 30 days to circulate a petition and get signatures from 10% of voters to give the public the opportunity to overturn their elected official's decision.
East County may be losing its only indoor regional shopping mall, or seeing major changes. Starwood Capital Group lost ownership of Parkway Plaza in El Cajon and six other U.S. malls after defaulting on Israeli-held bonds. A ratings downgrade of the debt earlier this year triggered a clause allowing bondholders to take control of the properties. Starwood purchased Parkway Plaza and six other malls from Westfield Shopping in 2013 for $1.6 billion and refinanced $268 million through the Israeli bond market. After Starwood defaulted, six parties bid on the portfolio. The winning bidder is a partnership between Pacific Retail Capital Partners and Golden East Investors at an undisclosed price. The new owners have indicated they plan to replace department store tenants or repurpose the malls into apartments or offices, the Wall Street Journal reports. But El Cajon Councilman Gary Kendrick says getting rid of East County's largest and only indoor regional shopping mall, quote, would be unacceptable, end quote. He anticipates the mall's new owners will face opposition to any such proposal from the city council. The property is zoned as a specific plan, not restricted by zoning, so the council has more freedom to approve or deny a variety of project types. As for turning the mall into apartments or offices, Kendrick says they'll have to get the city council's permission to do that. I think that's going to be an awfully hard sell. What could be feasible, he says, would be to allow the owner to add a housing component, as is being done to revitalize other malls and provide, quote, one-stop shopping, end quote, for residents. A second story might be added to the mall, or housing built where one of the outlying buildings owned by the mall is now. Loss of the regional retail center could mean a big reduction in city sales tax revenues. In a recent interview with The Real Deal, Starwood Capital's CEO Barry Sternlicht said the COVID-19 pandemic was a dagger to the chest for the retail industry. But Kendrick believes the Parkway Plaza Mall could be revived and thrive, unlike some in decaying inner cities, since redevelopment has already begun nearby. He hopes to see the ownership change lead to revitalization of the shopping mall and vicinity, which recently had a new hotel go in across the street, as well as new restaurants. Parkway Plaza recently lost Sears, a longtime tenant, but still retains Macy's, JCPenney, Walmart, and other large tenants, including a sporting goods store, furniture retail, office supply, and home goods store, as well as many smaller retailers and restaurants. But the mall has been hard hit by the pandemic, losing months of rent. Only this month did the mall reopen for indoor shopping, per state and local health orders. If the mall were to close permanently, San Diego County's vast inland area would have only Grossmont Center in La Mesa, a smaller outdoor shopping mall left as an alternative, or the outdoor Viejas Outlet Center in Alpine. To find a large indoor mall, East County residents would have to travel all the way to Fashion Valley, a mall where full parking lots and traffic jams often discourage even the most determined shoppers during busy holiday shopping times. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
By a 3-2 vote on Tuesday, the County Board of Supervisors withdrew its application for state grant funding to convert a Holiday Inn motel in La Mesa into a transitional living and long-term supportive housing facility for the homeless and those at risk of homelessness. Supervisors reversed an earlier decision after hearing from La Mesa's mayor and many residents most opposed to the project. The main objection was lack of transparency and inadequate notice given to most city officials and the public. Under grilling by Supervisor Diane Jacob, a staffer revealed that the county first notified La Mesa Councilman Colin Parent on August 12th about the project, but he did not immediately inform any other council members of the proposal or city staff. The city council did not learn about the project, in fact, until after the county had submitted its grant application, so city leaders and the public had no opportunity for input. Parent has drawn criticism for accepting campaign contributions from the executive director of Affirmed Housing, the project developer, and for donations that Affirmed Housing made to underwrite Circulate San Diego, a nonprofit of which Parent is executive director and general counsel. After drawing public criticism on social media for his apparent conflict of interest, Parent ultimately did recuse himself from voting when La Mesa City Council voted 4-0 on Monday night to ask supervisors to withdraw the grant application, which the supervisors did one day later. La Mesa Mayor Mark Rapostathis told supervisors, "The city was never contacted by the county. The developers contacted a council member." He added that the city's homeless task force also opposed this particular program, and moreover, losing the Holiday Inn, which was not listed for sale at the time of the proposal, would mean the city losing $500,000 in hotel occupancy taxes. While the city has been moving forward seeking solutions to help its approximately 52 homeless people in La Mesa, it objected to the county's plan to fill some 140 units with homeless from unincorporated areas of East County, with no guarantee of how many units would actually be available to help La Mesa's own homeless. Many also voiced objections to the project not requiring residents to be free of drugs and alcohol, raising concerns over drug-related crimes at nearby homes and businesses. Affirmed Housing Executive Vice President Jimmy Silverwood told supervisors the facility would include on-site wraparound services with voluntary participation, everything from job training to drug counseling. He claimed that 90% of residents at the company's similar projects in other cities chose to participate in at least some of those services. However, the Housing First model mandated by the state does not allow restricting occupancy to require that residents be sober or drug-free. The county had a very narrow window to apply for about $36 million in CARES Act funds for the project available through the state under the Home Key program, but that fast-track schedule allowed for no community meetings until after the grant application. At Tuesday's supervisors' hearing, some did urge support of the proposal. Deborah Fountain, who is with a supportive housing group, urged supervisors to move forward with the grant application. She cited an urgent, critical need in San Diego County for supportive housing, and noted that funds were available only short-term. She added, "The pandemic has thrown a light on health impacts on those who do not have homes for social distancing and quarantine, on top of 10-year-long wait times for subsidized housing, leaving those who are unable to pay rent due to COVID-19 with no place to go." Dave Myers, a retired sheriff officer who lives about a mile west of the proposed project, said concerns about crime were misplaced since hotels themselves have drawn crimes such as human trafficking. Myers said, "I am in full support of conversion to make supportive housing permanent with wraparound services." But Ernie Valdez voiced opposition and called for Councilman Parent to resign. Supervisor Jacob made a motion to withdraw the application, calling the process very flawed. She said, "I don't believe it's worth the money to force the project on the city of La Mesa, where officials voted and don't want it." Supervisors Gaspar and Desmond joined with her, while Supervisors Cox and Fletcher voted no. At the earlier La Mesa City Council meeting, the most blistering denunciation came from former Mayor Art Madrid. In a letter read aloud during the meeting, Madrid said of Parent, "His campaign promise to La Mesa voters was to protect the character and values of community. He's been an abject failure in honoring any of his pledges. He further deceived La Mesa residents by placing his self-serving political interests and priorities before those benefiting the city or its residents." And, former Mayor Madrid concluded, "The city's homeless task force is currently addressing this matter in a thoughtful way. Colin's sole support for the conversion is for the benefit of his friends at Affirmed Housing, not the city or its residents." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine, and Today, I'm interviewing Mark Papenfuss, who's one of the six candidates running for the La Mesa City Council meeting. Mark had had a family emergency recently when we did the candidate forum, wasn't able to be there, but he's been gracious enough to join us today. So, Mark, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for working with me, and I do appreciate it.
So I'd like to start by just asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself. Why are you running for the La Mesa City Council? What are your qualifications? And what do you most hope to accomplish if you're elected?
Well, first off, you know, let me say thank you to you and the East County Magazine for organizing this meeting. You know, it's a very unusual time with everything going on. I also want to thank everyone who's watching and listening to this and taking the time to participate in things like this, because it shows people have a true love and concern for the city of La Mesa. And that means, you know, that you and I have something in common. So with that being said, hi, my name is Mark Papenfuss. I'd like to be your newest member of the La Mesa City Council. I'm just a normal guy. I've had ties to the La Mesa area for over 25 years now. I know firsthand, the struggles of trying to raise a family in the city. Like many of you, I'm frustrated in the path the city has taken, especially over the last 4 years, where I've watched us, you know, almost lose the beloved farmers market and all the deals being made to developers, having the buildings burned down during a riot in our beautiful downtown village. I've watched countless city council meetings, and I've attended town halls back when they were actually town halls. I've long wondered why the voice of the people of La Mesa was not being listened to. You know, I have no political ties here. People may try to tell you that's a bad thing, but I think it's a good thing, because what that means is my only obligation is to the people of La Mesa. You know, vote for me is not only just to vote for me, but to vote for the people of La Mesa. I don't have to listen to corporations. I don't have to listen to developers. All I have to do is listen to the people of La Mesa.
Very good. As you mentioned, Mark, La Mesa has been the target of protests over police action and racial justice issues, and then they suffered that devastating riot in late May where there was looting and three buildings burned down. Yeah. What do you believe needs to be done to address concerns over racial justice, what the protesters were worried about, and police actions in this increasingly diverse population, while also making sure that the police are able to protect public safety and not have another riot?
Yeah. You know, I truly believe the police should be the pillar of the community. They should have the trust of the people. They should always act in the best interest of the people. I think we have a great opportunity now with a new police chief coming in to really try to work with that police chief, whoever we hire, to make sure they're open to feedback. They're open to, you know, community feedback. They're being transparent. They're really trying to be part of the community. There's a lot of work to do from the top down, and I think this is really a good opportunity for that to happen. There's been a lot of different reports that have come out recently showing, you know, the targeting being done, the use of force incidents not being looked into. And I think, you know, with the police oversight committee that we're trying to start up, I think that's a great start. I'd like to have them, all these things out on the use of force reports, have those looked into so that transparency is there, the accountability is there. Because right now, I don't think the accountability or the transparency has been there in the past. And I think that's really what led us to where we were. That path, it wasn't a short path. It was a long path that we took over many years. But I think we have a great, great opportunity to change that and to make great changes within the police.
Thank you. The burning of the banks and the closure of some businesses downtown has been tragic, but it also presents redevelopment opportunities. I know you've talked about rising from the ashes, helping the city to do that. Can you give us some specific on what you think about that? I know we've seen ideas floated that have included everything from a town square with outdoor dining, more housing or mixed-use development, maybe that long-promised library, or even a new home for the farmers market, or just more parking. So tell us what you think should be done in terms of downtown redevelopment.
I think we should do everything we can to help businesses come back to La Mesa, especially the village. I love the village. The village is really what made me fall in love with La Mesa, that small town charm. You know, as far as more development goes in the village, I'm really against it. Parking is rare downtown. It's one of the main things people complain about going to the village. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons they delayed the farmer's market. They really stripped down the farmer's market from what it could be, was because of parking. So I think the city public lot that we have, that needs to stay. we can't control private land. That's not something the city can really control, who buys and sells it. Yeah. But we can control the land that the city owns. So I think we shouldn't be selling any city land. You know, we should be putting a downtown library in there that was promised to the people a long time ago. That's very important to me to get that accomplished, to make parking as, you know, as easy as could be to find. I know if you have to drive around looking for parking, most people are just going to leave and go someplace else. So that's not what I want. I want people to come downtown to the village, find a parking spot, have dinner, do some shopping, things like that. So expanding the farmer's market, I think, is also important. It really can be much bigger and better than what it is now. I want to give a spot to the local businesses within the farmer's market, so people not in the village, they can come and promote their business and really help the city grow. More small businesses are very important to me. And I think La Mesa has lost a lot of small businesses, and it's been going on for a long time. I think it's been going on since before COVID hit. So you really can't blame COVID on the loss of all these businesses. Yes, COVID has hit us hard, but it's not all to blame. It's been going on long before that. So that's something I really want to focus on.
The housing shortage and homelessness are two problems in our region. Let's start with housing in general. How would you balance the state requirements for more housing, especially affordable housing, versus those who are concerned about retaining character of communities and making sure there's enough parking? And can you also specifically include your views about height limits with regard to housing projects?
Yeah, definitely. I think the height limits are very important to start with that. I don't want us, you know, downtown San Diego is a good example of really tall buildings, and I don't like that. I don't ever want us to be like downtown San Diego. I think the height limits in the village, the two stories, that's fine. If you go further out, I think maybe four or five would be the limit as far as what I would like to see. I don't want huge buildings. It's not a good fit for the community. It brings parking issues, it brings traffic issues, and one thing that no one really talks about is the schools. La Mesa has a higher than average student per teacher ratio. How more apartments to the area, that's just going to get worse. And that's something that's going to hurt the kids. And, you know, a lot of people may say, I don't mind if they build an apartment building over there. That doesn't affect me. The parking over there doesn't affect me. I'm over here in this part of La Mesa. But anyone with kids, anyone with grandkids, nieces, nephews, whatever, the schooling will be affected. Building lots of new apartments in La Mesa will negatively affect kids, which will affect them the rest of their lives. I don't think La Mesa has a shortage of housing. Go on Fletcher Parkway, El Cajon, La Mesa border, you drive down Fletcher Parkway, there's literally apartments all the way down to the freeway. And even if you go past the freeway, there's still apartments, solid apartments. I don't think there's a housing shortage. I think what we have is an affordability shortage. You know, these new apartment complexes are being proposed where there's 50 units and maybe four of them, maybe five, are affordable. And we're being told that this is a good thing. I don't think building a 50-unit complex with fewer than 50 parking spaces with four units that are affordable, that's not a good thing. That's not really helping anybody. That's something I want to go away from. If they want to build apartment complexes, I want to see as many of those units be affordable.
On homelessness, I don't know if you're familiar with the latest wrinkle that we just heard about last night, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
While La Mesa's been taking steps to try to address homelessness with a task force and some other actions, the state has stepped in now in the county, and they've come up with this proposal that supervisors actually voted on without telling anybody who lives in La Mesa about it. And the city heard about it, and they're having this special meeting, you know, coming up, and the supervisors are going to do a revote here. But at any rate, what the state and the county want to do is put in a homeless facility where the Holiday Inn is that would have about 140 units or so. The problem from La Mesa's point of view, it'd be great if this was for the 50 homeless people in La Mesa, but they want to bring in the homeless people in the unincorporated parts of the county in Spring Valley and Lakeside primarily. It's unclear whether it would include any La Mesa folks. And from what I'm hearing, there isn't going to be a requirement, you know, for them to be clean and sober or anything. So I was going to ask you in general your ideas about addressing La Mesa's homeless problem, but also if you can address specifically what you think about that particular proposal.
I haven't had much time to look at it. I did see it. I saw the basics of that. I was waiting for the city council meeting, more information to come out on that. But my initial response is, you know, homeless people are an issue everywhere. It's not just a La Mesa problem.
Right.
And everyone wants to take care of the homeless people, but no one really wants them in their backyard. And I think helping people, bottom line, I think that's important. If they're La Mesa people, if they're not, you know, from La Mesa, you know, my initial reaction, as long as we're helping people, as long as we're doing what we need to do to help people, I think that's a good thing. I need to see more details on it, obviously, but my initial reply is if people are being taken care of, if they're getting the help they need, be clean, be sober, get back on their feet, I'm all for that. I have no problems with that. That's something I think is something we as a society really need to focus on, helping our neighbors, you know, whether they be next door, down the street, or the next city over. I think that's a very important, very good quality to have.
Yes, it is. All right. The pandemic has impacted many residents severely. The city recently gave out $1 million in CARES funding to residents, or to businesses, rather, and $600,000 to renters. The application period closed early because they had so many responses. If they get additional CARES Act funds, what would your priority be for how those should be spent?
You know, there's no right answer to this. You could say more goes to business. You could say more goes to the people. There's really strong arguments either way. You give money to the businesses. They provide tax revenue for the city. They provide jobs, or if you give people, you know, money to the people, it keeps them from getting evicted. So there's really no right answer to who gets what. How, I think there is a wrong answer here. You know, the money, the city kept some of that money for themselves. And I'll be honest, I don't know if there's a requirement for the city to keep a percentage. I can't imagine there is, but I think 100% of that money that the city got should have went either to businesses or to the people. The city has a nice reserve fund for emergency purposes. Mm-hmm. This is not an emergency. I don't know what is. So if the city needed money to pay for, you know, sterilization things, tests or whatever, dip into the reserves, use that money. Every single penny we get to help people, whether it be a business or a person, should go to those people. For those businesses.
Not reimbursing the city for its costs. Okay.
Right. That's to me, that's ridiculous. And, you know, but I think that's the only wrong answer here is for the city to keep a single penny of that money.
Can you speak to the issue of police funding? There are some people who have been calling for either defunding the police or reallocating some police resources into things like, different alternative responses to homelessness, to mental illness, calls involving those sorts of things, while others say, gosh, after the riot, we need more police protection, not less. What are your views on that?
That's something we'd really have to take a look at. I believe the more money that you put into a community, the better. One of the long-standing complaints I've heard about the La Mesa Police Department is how much money they're getting, you know, the military items they have, and if they really need those. And that's something that I'd want to take a look at to see if that's something that, if it's a good use of money. The homeless task force that was being presented, some of that money for that funding for that was going to come from the police department. You know, they were trying to get money from grants to cover that. If it didn't cover all the cost of the task force, then some of that money would come from the police force. And that's basically, in essence, defunding the police. It's not, you're not dismantling the police force. You're just taking the money from this area and putting it over here. And I think the police right now are being used as a catch-all, and I'm not a big fan of that, where they have to respond to so many different things. If you take away some of the responses they do, especially for the homeless people, you know, that frees them up, lets them focus more on being a police officer and not being a social worker. You know, they were hired to be a police officer. They weren't hired to be social workers. So I think they really need to focus on that. If we could have other people do other things as far as the homeless are concerned, for example, it's a good thing. If we could take more money and put it back in the community, that's a good thing. So that's something we really need to look at. I want to look at other cities about our size and about with the same safety level as us. You know, La Mesa overall is a safe city. And I want to look at how other cities our size, percent, not dollar amounts, because you can't compare dollars to dollars from one city to another, but percentage, like how much of a percentage of our budget goes to the police force and how much of a percentage goes to, you know, other aspects, and then see if that's in line. If we see something that's way out of line, then we need to ask, why is that being spent? And we need to resolve that either way. So that's something we really need to take a look at.
Super. Mark, can you tell us what kind of leadership experience or management or business experience you have that might be relevant to serving on the city council and addressing its issues? And also, we've asked every candidate this. Can you disclose if you have any ties that would be potential conflicts of interest, any business interests or other things that might potentially have you recused from a vote? And if so, what is it?
No conflicts of interest. I'm just a normal guy. I'm not taking any money from any developers. I'm not taking any money from big corporations. Any donations I get are for, you know, friends and people who support me within the community. I think that's very important to have, you know, so you're not having to listen to other people. Because even if you say, even if legally, you know, you don't have a conflict of interest, if you're taking money from a certain individual or a certain organization that deals within the city, that presents the idea that you have a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
I have none of that. What I do is I work for a big telecommunications company, one of the largest within the nation. I handle, really my primary role is to handle the federal complaints, the high level executive complaints. So I work with people across the country, work with many, many different departments, coordinate, you know, resolution, positive resolutions for the issues that are brought to within my company. It really does involve a lot of work, a lot of thinking outside the box, staying within policy, and really making sure everybody is happy as much as possible. There's times where, you know, not everyone's going to be happy, but compromise is a big part of that. And I think that's an important aspect for anyone to have, the ability to compromise.
Yeah, it is.
Because especially in politics, you're not going to get what you want all the time. If that happens, you should go buy a lottery ticket.
No one wants to see a bunch of people up there fighting and bickering over everything. Yeah,
right.
they want solutions,
so,
I think.
Exactly. So working as, you have to realize you have the same goal. You know, you, person A, person B, they have the same goal. You just have to realize how to get there. That's really what I do all day, every day, figuring out how to get to that resolution. And I have a lot of experience. I've been doing this for a long time. It's something that I think I'm pretty good at. And I think it will come in handy within the city council.
Well, Mark, I'm going to let you have the final word today in your closing statements. Go ahead. And if there's anything else that we didn't ask you about that you want to get out there, now's your time to say it. And then just give us your best case for why you think you're the best one to represent La Mesa on the city council.
Well, definitely. And again, thank you. You know, this really is it's an uncharted time for our city with all the recent events, both locally and globally. It really hit us hard in many, many different ways. You know, our city has a strenuous path ahead of us, and I ask for your trust and support in navigating this path. I know I'm really at a huge disadvantage here, running against people who are going to vastly outspend me and make obligations to large outside groups and big political organizations. Mm-hmm. You know, these obligations mean they really have to listen to what these organizations want, even if it means going against what the people of La Mesa want. I'm running this campaign from my heart, running it on behalf of the people like you who call La Mesa home. I think the voice of the people should always be listened to, and the actions of the city council should be based on that. And it shouldn't be based on personal agendas that go against what the people of La Mesa want. You know, it's my opinion that the leadership and experience we've had for the last 4 years has really led us to where we are now. And it's time for a reset. You know, it's time for a fresh set of eyes to address the issues that the city of La Mesa faces today. So again, my name is Mark Papenfuss, and I ask for your support on this upcoming election.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us and sharing your views.
Thank you.
Viewers, there are 6 candidates running. If you go to our website at eastcountymagazine.org and you click into our communities, our La Mesa communities section or our politics section, you'll be able to find videos of all of them, 3 who did the debate and or the forum and Two others that did individual Zoom interviews like this will also be airing this on KNSJ Radio 89.1 FM, Descanso. So with that, I just want to thank you, Mark, and encourage everybody out there, if you're not already registered to vote, you can go to sdvote.com. There's still time. Check your registration, vote, and we will see you all on Election Day.
Thank you.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, I'm Mike Clifford. President Donald Trump Wednesday would not commit to providing a peaceful transition of power after Election Day. CNN reports that is lending further fuel to concerns he may not relinquish his office should he lose in November. Quoting Trump, well, we're going to have to see what happens. CNN notes that Trump had previously refused to say whether he would accept the election results, echoing his sentiments from 2016, and he has joked, he says, about staying in office well past the constitutionally bound two terms. CNN adds his refusal to guarantee a violence-free transition went further and is likely to alarm opponents already on edge, given his deployment of federal law enforcement to quell protests in American cities. A fourth major clinical trial for a COVID vaccine debuted on Wednesday. Public health experts are asking for help.
Millions of volunteers are needed to aid in the effort, but so far just 410,000 people have signed up. COVID-19 Prevention Network Executive Director Dr. Jim Kublin says everyone is going to benefit from these vaccines, so we should all be willing to pitch in.
We desperately need the general public to volunteer for these vaccine clinical trials. This is a tremendous way for people to step up and really accomplish their civic duty by contributing to the advancement of these COVID vaccines.
It takes about 5 minutes to enter your information on the website preventcovid.org. No one in the trial will be infected with the virus itself. If you are chosen, you'll be given an injection of either a placebo or of the possible vaccine and be studied for several years. Side effects are usually limited to redness and swelling at the injection site. Hundreds of sites are activated every week, so it's not too late to get involved. Study participants are paid for their time, usually a few $100s. A growing anti-vaccine movement has questioned the safety or effectiveness of some immunizations in recent years. Patients are advised to consult their doctor with any concerns. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Native American groups now hope the president will sign a measure designed to help law enforcement get a handle on a public safety issue that's plaguing tribal communities.
Earlier this week, Congress gave final approval to Savannah's Act, which addresses cases of missing and murdered indigenous people. It orders the Justice Department to develop guidelines to solve and prevent these cases while establishing data collection. Lisa Casares of North Dakota Native Vote says the public finally is noticing that natives are easily targeted for horrific crimes and that this will hopefully bring some solace.
It's considered positive considering, you know, this has been a longstanding issue within any country that, you know, the missing and murdered indigenous women and indigenous people.
The bill is named after Savannah Graywind, a pregnant Native American woman who was brutally murdered in 2017. Her body was found along the North Dakota-Minnesota border. Indigenous women face more violence than any other group. The National Institute of Justice says at least 84% of these women have been the target of sexual or other violence in their lifetimes. I'm Mike Moen.
And finally, Eric Lattice tells us wildfires becoming more common and severe due to climate change and its warmer, drier conditions across the West. Now, health experts are warning that people exposed to wildfire smoke are also at increased risk for COVID-19 infection.
Cheryl Perosi is a pulmonary physician with University of Utah Health. She says the overlap of wildfire season with the coronavirus pandemic has sharply increased health risks.
Wildfire smoke itself has harmful health effects, and there's a growing body of research showing that air pollution exposure increases risk for COVID-19 infection and more severe disease or more death.
She says wildfire smoke includes a complex mixture of dangerous particulate pollution, which can cause inflammation and suppress the body's natural immune system, increasing the risk for respiratory viral infections, including COVID-19.
I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We're member and listener supported on great radio stations across America and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. The state announced Tuesday that San Diego County remains in Tier 2, the red tier, after narrowly keeping COVID-19 cases just below the threshold that would have shifted our region into the more restrictive Tier 1, or purple tier. That means that recently reopened businesses will not have to shut down again or reduce capacity for at least 2 weeks, and schools retain the option to provide in-classroom learning. The state rejected the county's argument to exclude San Diego State University's outbreak cases from the county's total, but fortunately, even with the SDSU cases included, the region remained under the trigger level of 7 cases per 100,000 population, just barely at 6.9 per 100,000. The state uses two metrics, case rates and testing positivity, to determine which tier to assign. On positivity rates, the county is doing much better at 3.8%, well below the 4.9% that would qualify it for the even less restrictive orange tier. But both metrics have to be met for 2 weeks for the county to drop down into the orange tier, which would allow many businesses to increase capacity. The state has also eased restrictions on nail salons, which, along with hair salons and barber shops, will now be allowed to stay open inside even if a county shifts back into the purple tier. County Public Health Officer Dr. Wilma Wooten called the state's decision good news that is supportive of regaining economic activity. Cases spiked here after a mid-June reopening of many businesses and then leveled off in August after the state imposed new restrictions. New openings since then, along with the Labor Day weekend, could yet lead to an uptick, however. Dr. Wooten told supervisors she and her staff have been meeting with colleges and universities that have reopened to review their safety plans and provide best practices. She said, "We're trying to get in front of any potential issues." Dr. Wooten urged everyone to wash hands frequently, wear masks, and practice social distancing to help continue to reduce our region's case rates and enable our economy to recover. Public testimony at the supervisors' meeting this week included some people in favor of loosening restrictions and others who want to maintain them. A tattoo parlor owner said his business uses protective equipment and should be allowed to stay open, noting that others with less safety procedures in place, such as restaurants, have reopened and caused outbreaks. But Michelle Krug urged county decision makers to stick to science and not continue to look at reopening sooner than makes sense. She added that hundreds of cases among San Diego State students prove we are still in danger, and she urged the supervisors, "Stay strong in doing what will be best in the long run when we look at history backwards and what made sense for our community."
No candidate signed up to run for San Miguel Fire District's board in Division 6, which includes the La Prensa area and part of Spring Valley. So, the board is taking applications through October 6th to fill the vacancy. Directors are paid a small stipend of $170 per board meeting, plus a modest per diem for attending other events on behalf of the district. The directors will review the applications and make a recommendation to the County Board of Supervisors, who will make the final appointment, says Fire Chief Chris Brainerd. San Miguel Consolidated Fire Protection District is one of the largest fire districts in San Diego County, covering around 50 square miles of service area and providing fire and emergency medical services to nearly 140,000 residents. For a map of Division 6, visit our website, eastcountymagazine.org, and enter search term San Miguel. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz. Community cleanup events are slated in Hakumba and Potrero. The Hakumba event will be on October 17th at the Hakumba Community Park. In Potrero, The event is set for November 21st at Potrero Community Park. Both cleanup events will be held from 8 a.m. until dumpsters are full. In addition, chipping of green waste will be available from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. at both locations. Residents can bring e-waste such as computers, TVs, phones, or batteries, as well as furniture, box springs, appliances, mattress, and other oversized trash for recycling. The following items will not be accepted: construction materials, large appliances, ammunition, medications, medical waste, explosive or radioactive materials. Due to COVID-19, transport waste in the trunk or in the back bed of an SUV or pickup. Staff will not open vehicle doors to enter the interior. Safe distancing and facial coverings are required. The events are made possible by EDCO, the Real East County Fire Safe Council, and other community organizations.
The feds have until mid-December to decide whether to list the monarch butterfly as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, so groups concerned about the monarch's future are trying to raise public awareness. The western population of the iconic orange and black butterfly has declined by 99% since the 1980s. Serena Jepson with the Xerces Society says a decade ago, people might have seen 100,000 monarchs overwintering in their favorite habitats in California, but now there are often just a few dozen at each site.
Very notably, in the last two winters, which is when we count monarchs, we saw a really dramatic drop in the population.
Scientists believe that climate change, destruction of overwintering sites, and habitat loss are contributing to the massive declines in the butterfly population. If the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decides to list the monarch, it could block agricultural or commercial development or the use of pesticides in areas deemed to be critical habitat. The agency could decide to list the species as threatened. It also could decide a listing isn't warranted. And Jepson says there is a third option.
They can say, we've reviewed all the scientific evidence, and we believe that monarchs are warranted, but they're precluded by other priorities. So then monarchs would become a candidate species.
The Endangered Species Coalition has mounted a letter-writing campaign to local newspapers to raise awareness about preserving the monarch butterfly. And the Xerces Society website has information on how to get training to help with the annual monarch count, which takes place around Thanksgiving and New Year's. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Millions of citizens have not yet registered, so Jonathan Metastein with Common Cause is working to spread the word. Every vote counts. For a lot of low propensity voters, limited English speaking voters, young voters, and first time voters, they don't even realize that voter registration is that first step to voting. And so National Voter Registration Day is an opportunity to draw everyone's attention to the need to register to vote. It only takes a few minutes to register at registertovote.ca.gov. Or you can just register and vote on the same day at any polling place or vote center in the state. This year, California became the first state to send mail-in ballots and not just ballot request forms to every registered voter so people can vote from home without worrying about being exposed to COVID-19. Metastein says voters need to follow the directions on the ballot carefully. Hundreds of thousands of voters have problems with their vote by mail ballot every single election cycle, because they fail to sign the ballot envelope, or the signature on their ballot envelope doesn't match the signature that's on file, or they simply turn it in too late. President Donald Trump has railed against sending ballots to all registered voters, claiming it raises the risk of voter fraud. However, in the five states that do so, actual cases of fraud have been infinitesimal. All ballots are tracked with barcodes and go through extensive verification with signature matching technology. Metastein notes there has been no partisan advantage to vote by mail in past elections. Study after study has shown that if you increase access to vote by mail, it benefits voters by expanding access to the ballot, but it does not have a benefit for Democrats or Republicans. In-person voting locations will vary by county, so it's important to check your county registrar of voters website. 15 of the state's counties, including LA and Orange counties, have switched to a system of regional vote centers that are larger and open before the election. The other counties retain the traditional neighborhood polling places that are open on election day only. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I'd like to talk to you now about why we call fall our planting season in Southern California. Obviously, we don't want to plant in August and September when it is so hot and so miserable. So what would we want to plant now and why? Well, for now, even though the rains may not have started, and I'm talking about October, November, December, the nights are cooler, the days are cooler, we don't have those August heat waves of 100 degrees, and once the Santa Anas are through, it's a great time to get things in the ground. What's the best thing to plant now? Now is the time to put in your trees, your native plants, your fall flowers that you pick up at the local nursery, and not to plant tropicals. We don't put in any tropicals now. By tropicals, I mean all the plants you think of when you think of Hawaii, everything you think of when you think of house plants that can grow outdoors. These are all tropical plants that are subject to being frosted. They don't like cold winter weather, so don't put them in the ground now. If you are in a very frost-prone area, then what you don't want to do is plant your citrus, your avocados, and anything tender right now. Think about where the plants originated. You don't have to look up every single plant that you want to grow, but if something is called Japanese something or other, that means that it will get by with cold weather, and you don't have to worry about planting it now. If it's something that's called Hawaiian something, I would be very leery of planting it in the fall, because it's probably highly subject to freezes and frosts. Why would you want to plant natives now, and why would you want to put in shrubs and landscape plants now? The plants that you put in now will not show much visible growth during the winter time, but underground, all sorts of exciting things will be happening. The roots will be growing. The plants will be sitting there waiting to get started in the spring when it first gets to be hot weather. They'll take off like gangbusters. Maybe you went to the Water Conservation Garden and you saw the Chinese pistache trees. If you haven't been there to see them, I recommend you go. In the fall, they turn the most glorious color of red and orange. It's hard to describe how beautiful they are. This is also the time of year when you see the liquid ambers showing off, the sweet gum trees. They look great right now. How do you know you're going to buy one that looks wonderful for you? Now's the time. Go to the nursery now and look at the tree colors of the ones that you like and pick ones that change the colors that you like. There will be some variation in your yard because possibly your yard doesn't get as cold or isn't quite as wet or has a different kind of soil than the nursery has, but it's the best way to get the tree that you want for some gorgeous fall foliage. Why am I not telling you to plant your fruit trees now? Because you can save so much money if you wait until January. That's when the nurseries and the big box stores bring in the bare root plants. And when we get closer to that season, we'll have another session on here, and I'll give you all the instructions to have a great start on trees that will cost you $13 if you buy them in December or January, but they'll cost you $35 or $40 if you buy them in May.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producers, John Sepulveda and Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, royalty-free music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.